The judge deliberated for 16 hours and read her verdict in less than 5 minutes, starting with not guilty of aiding the enemy.
This week, leaker Bradley Manning escapes the worst charge, but may still face life in jail. Will that dissuade other leakers? From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. An American reporter is targeted by Russian hackers who send him an incriminating gift through the U.S. mail.
It was basically an express mail envelope, and inside was a magazine from the Chicago Tribune. And taped to the back of that magazine were 13 individual packets of heroin.
Plus, this summer has seen a deluge of lawsuits brought by unpaid interns seeking compensation.
And the truth is that they were most of the time exploited. They should have been paid minimum wage, and they want their pound of flesh.
There's so much more after this.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Gee whiz, what a whirlwind of activity this week surrounding the nation's incredible, definitely not shrinking security apparatus. A big verdict in the Bradley Manning case, new revelations on NSA domestic spying, a reporter compelled to burn confidential sources, you name it. But depending on which cluster of news stories you focused on, it was hard to tell if the country is re-embracing basic civil liberties or heading deeper down the rabbit hole in the direction of the security state. In a week of mixed signals, there was most prominently the Bradley Manning verdict.
Now, Manning was convicted in the biggest leak of classified documents in U.S. history.
The judge deliberated for 16 hours and read her verdict in less than 5 minutes, starting with not guilty of aiding the enemy, a charge which could have brought Bradley Manning a maximum sentence of life without parole.
The charge of aiding the enemy, barely distinguishable from treason, was seen even by a military court as a case of government overreach. Overreach was a recurring theme this week, as Deputy Attorney General James Cole tried to persuade senators that the NSA's vacuuming of domestic phone records was done lawfully.
With these programs and other intelligence activities, we are constantly seeking to achieve the right balance between the protection of national security and the protection of privacy and civil liberties.
But a bipartisan chorus pushed back, including Democrats who accused the administration of actively misleading Congress about intelligence efforts. At a hearing Wednesday at which the controversial PRISM program revealed by leaker Edward Snowden was officially declassified, Minnesota Democrat Al Franken vowed to introduce legislation forcing the Obama administration to come clean.
I don't want a situation where the government is transparent only when it's convenient for the government.
And suddenly, the American public, scared out of its wits since September 11th, 2001, is beginning to conclude that the intelligence community has gone too far. A new poll from the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press shows that 56% of the public believes the courts are not protecting us from invasion of privacy. And, says Pew's Michael Dimmock, they are suspicious of worse.
70% of the people we interviewed said that the government is not just limiting this to terrorism, that they're using this data for other purpose there. 63% of the people we interviewed said this data collection is not limited to metadata, that they're also collecting what's being said in our phone calls and our emails.
Since 9/11, the public has shown its willingness to suffer all sorts of indignities for the sake of protecting the homeland from terrorist attack. The patience seems to be wearing thin.
This is the first poll we've conducted where more people said, no, I'm not worried that they're not doing enough. I'm worried that they're going too far.
Meanwhile, journalist Glenn Greenwald offered details of even more chilling intelligence capacities alluded to by admitted NSA leaker Edward Snowden back in June.
But I, sitting at my desk, certainly had the authorities to wiretap anyone, from you or your accountant to a federal judge to even the president if I had a personal email.
An NSA PowerPoint deck for a snooping program called X Keyscore illustrated how countless analysts can sit at a computer and summon internet search histories and other private information for anyone, anyone simply by plugging in an email address, an IP address, or a name, which, if true, is not about impersonal metadata, but tracking data of the most personal kind. And who knows what jeopardy Greenwald himself might be in? Having passed along secrets leaked by Snowden, will he be in jeopardy? Will his other sources? Armed with a favorable appeals court decision, this week the government continued its legal effort to coerce New York Times reporter and author James Risen to testify about where he obtained still other government secrets. Yes, the same administration that says it supports a federal shield law protecting reporters and their sources is refusing to lift its subpoena compelling Risen to reveal his sources, which is why Senator Franken wants to legislate accountability. The first impulse of an aspiring security state, after all, is to be secure from the scrutiny and the authority and the sanction of the public. Actually, no reporter has ever been prosecuted for publishing leaked information, but Gabriel Schoenfeld, author of Necessary Secrets, National Security, the Media, and Rule of Law, says there may be a legal basis for indicting journalists, one that dates back to World War II.
The Battle of Midway was the decisive battle of the Pacific War for the United States, and we won that battle in large measure because of a secret weapon. We had broken Japanese codes. Now, after the Battle of Midway, almost immediately afterwards, a Chicago Tribune reporter by the name of Stanley Johnston, who had been embedded in the fleet, published a story essentially revealing that the United States had broken Japanese codes. This was the most damaging leak in our history, I think. If the Japanese had acted on what the story said, thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of American servicemen would have died in the years ahead. The war would have been prolonged. It would have changed the course of history radically.
Just to be clear, he did not write in an article that the United States had broken the Japanese code. What he wrote after the battle was the position of the Japanese fleet. The reason he knew that was because he had been leaked the information of the fleet's deployment by an officer on the ship, and the Japanese could have deduced that the U.S. had broken the code. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been able to write what he wrote.
Yes, that's an accurate rendition of what occurred. The damage was potentially very severe.
A grand jury was impaneled to investigate whether this breach of intelligence rose to the level of criminal transgression. Ultimately, the grand jury was disbanded before handing up an indictment.
Right. The grand jury was disbanded because the government did not want to call attention to a story that they assumed the Japanese had not noticed. And they assumed that large measure because the Japanese did not change their codes. This story was picked up and used elsewhere. So it was out there. And it sort of beggars the imagination to believe that the Japanese agents in the United States did not notice the story. And the best explanation for the reason why they didn't change their codes is not that they didn't see the story, but they just believed so absolutely in the strength of their codes and in the inability of Americans to read Japanese. So they had a kind of hubris that cost them.
Even though the case was not pursued, there's still a kernel of precedent in an opinion that was written at the time by the Office of Legal Counsel.
Well, the Justice Department has just declassified a whole bunch of Office of Legal Counsel memos. This is one of the more fascinating documents in that newly declassified collection because it shows us what the government was thinking about this case. And Attorney General Francis Biddle had asked the Assistant Solicitor General, Oscar Cox, whether reporters could be prosecuted under the Espionage Act. And he concluded that the reporter could be prosecuted.
One of the difficulties of prosecuting these cases, apart from the basic constitutional ones, is the burden of proof on the part of the government that there was an intention to do harm.
The intention question is the key here. And the most interesting part of the memo takes up what the reporter's intention was. It says, on the one hand, his conduct was reckless and negligent rather than specifically intended to do harm. So in that sentence, he doesn't have intent. But in the next sentence, the memo goes on to say, yet the negligence and recklessness were of such magnitude as to be fairly characterized as criminal and evil.
But those are contradictory, are they not?
They are to some degree contradictory. They suggest that when the damage is so obvious, the state of mind, the intention is there. As the memo goes on to say, it is hard to believe that any judge or jury would take a sympathetic view of his case. It was characterized by real turpitude and disregard of his obligations as a citizen.
Let's cut and paste that argument and apply it to WikiLeaks or Edward Snowden in The Guardian or anyone who is currently under the scrutiny of the government. If you can just, by reckless disregard for consequences, be found to have criminal intent, does that bode poorly for them and for journalists in general?
Well, this 1942 document doesn't have any legal standing. It's a snapshot of what the Office of Legal Counsel was thinking about this issue in 1942 in the midst of a very hot war. So I think a modern Office of Legal Counsel looking at this kind of case might take a somewhat different view of it. And I think that the wrestling here with the intent might have to be handled somewhat differently. It does seem to be a little tangled.
Now, I was astonished, actually, at the idea that no journalist has ever been prosecuted, for example, revealing troop positions or any other sensitive strategic or tactical information in the course of battle. I'm stunned that in the history of American wars going back nearly three centuries, that nobody has blundered his way into a prosecution.
Well, I think that's a great thing, but it also, I think, reflects the government's reticence about prosecuting the press and out of respect for the First Amendment, because certainly there have been very damaging leaks that have occurred over the past decades where a case similar to the one that the government began to mount against the Chicago Tribune in 1942 could have been mounted against the New York Times, say, for some of the stories it published. But the political costs would have been great, and we haven't seen any prosecutions.
What happens if the government ever does prosecute the press for essentially aiding the enemy?
Well, I think it would set a terrible precedent in a way, but perhaps a necessary one if the press does something that endangers the American people. Fortunately, there's been restraint on both sides since the Chicago Tribune story. For whatever dangerous leaks have occurred, there are many other stories that the press has sat on precisely because they've been told that loss of life might occur or our national interests would be damaged. But, you know, we live in a very different kind of world now where there are not just American newspapers covering our national defense establishment. We have British newspapers like The Guardian. The editors there are not really subject to the restraints that American editors are there, or they think about politics in a different way. And yet they have free rein to roam around Washington and also uncover secrets.
Gabriel, thank you very much.
Pleasure to be here.
Gabriel Schoenfeld is author of Necessary Secrets, National Security, the Media, and the Rule of Law. His latest book is A Bad Day on the Romney Campaign, an insider's account.
Coming up, From Russia with Love and Heroin.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. At GatesFoundation.org, the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at JoyceFDN.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, Edward Snowden, former NSA employee, recent leaker of huge domestic surveillance programs, and current fugitive, was given temporary asylum in Russia. There's a certain inevitability in that. Back in the pre-digital 1940s, telegrams were the basis of the first large-scale domestic surveillance program launched by an agency that would become the NSA. Joe Clock, a writer for Daily Dot, has been exploring that history. Joe, welcome to On the Media.
Great to be here.
August 1945. It's the end of World War II. We all know that the Allies' success in that outcome had a great deal to do with foreign intelligence. How did telegrams come into play at that point?
Well, at that point, it was still a major means of international communication. Particularly of interest at the time was the U.S. and Russia. There was that awareness that there's this pipeline going on between covert spies in the U.S. and Russian intelligence. 12 days before the Trinity test that was proof positive of the atomic bomb, the plans for this bomb had been leaked to Russia. And so these telegrams were a way to dig into the pipeline right at the source.
So the army came in and said, we want a direct line into the traffic of international telegrams to the three major telegraph companies, right? Which were AT&T World International, RCA Global, and Western Union. But specifically, what did they ask for?
The copies of all of the internationally exchanged telegrams. What they would do is a courier would go to major offices in San Antonio, San Francisco, New York, and Washington, D.C., and pick up punch card style things, if you can imagine. Later on, it was magnetic tape, but they would take all of this back to the agency offices, and they would particularly look for encrypted messages or messages that had some sort of double meaning.
So this was always intended to track foreign communications, but obviously Americans would get swept up in that net. That's one of the places where you draw a direct parallel between this program, which was called Shamrock, and the program that was exposed by Edward Snowden, which was called PRISM.
Right. In both cases, what you ultimately have is an organization that is the NSA, that is collecting a massive amount of information about private citizens.
There was another parallel you drew, which was the company's reaction to being plundered, I suppose, in this way.
When the companies were originally approached in the case of Shamrock, they didn't want to participate, and they asked for certain legal assurances from the executive branch and didn't initially get them, but over time did get these sort of underhanded assurances that things would not go poorly for them if they participated. But it was always sold to them and put on them as this idea of a patriotic duty.
Did they ever get the assurances that they sought?
In a funny way, yes, they did in 2008.
In 2008?
In 2008, when an amendment was passed to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, it guaranteed protection for telecommunication companies that aid the government in matters of national security. It was retroactive protection.
If anybody wanted to sue Western Union now, Western Union would be protected.
Exactly.
Under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the same act that gave rise to the FISA courts. There weren't any FISA courts back in the early days of the NSA, right? When it was overseeing Shamrock, what kind of oversight was there?
There was very, very little oversight. The agency only had one lawyer, and as legend has it, he arranged to have his position abolished so he could retire.
So Shamrock continued from the 50s, and in the mid-70s come a series of revelations about surveillance, both domestic and foreign, among them an expose of Shamrock. So what happens then?
Well, in response to that, the Church Committee was formed, which was specifically designated to investigate all of these different projects.
Headed by Senator Frank Church.
Right. That evolved into the Senate Intelligence Committee, which is now responsible for investigating PRISM. You ultimately have a very similar project that's sort of technologically updated being investigated by the committee that is the successor to the one that investigated Shamrock, and debating many of the same laws that were established surrounding Shamrock.
It just fills one with pride to see how far we've come, doesn't it, Joe?
Yeah.
So do you have any thoughts as the telegram fades away?
It was killed by its own successors, and I think that's the most admirable way a technology can go. We owe it a lot, reducing all of this information into the simplest little bit and then recreating it on the other side. That's just what we do all the time now.
Joe, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joe Clark is a writer for The Daily Dot. Today, Russia is notorious for sophisticated online identity fraudsters and credit card thieves. Last week, five men in Russia and Ukraine were charged with the hack of a dozen large corporations, allegedly stealing 160 million credit card numbers. Virginia-based journalist Brian Krebs writes about how to protect your computer from these kinds of criminals on his website, Krebs on Security. And criminals
really hate that. In the past 6 months, Krebs has suffered denial of service attacks on his website, had his cable bill paid for the next 3 years with stolen credit cards, and even fallen victim to a swatting. That's when police are tricked into checking your house for a non-existent shooting or a bomb. But all of that was nothing compared to the bizarre prank staged by some Russian cyber criminals this month, led by the administrator of an underground online forum of identity thieves.
He uses the nickname Fly and Flycracker. And I'm not really sure what this guy's problem is. He's kind of had it in for me for a while. His Twitter account avatar has always been some spoof of my picture. You know, whether it's like my severed head being held up or, you know, I mean, he changes it every once in a while. But this guy's had, he's had it in for me for a little while.
So here he is sitting presumably in Russia, or at least writing in Russian, and he says what?
I'm putting together a fund. We're all going to pool our money and buy Krebs some heroin because he's a smack addict and he's suffering from withdrawal. So, you know, we're going to fix him up so everything's okay.
And he got a bunch of people willing to contribute to this fund to buy you heroin?
Correct. Yeah, he raised about $200. And then he went on the Silk Road, probably the blackest of the black markets on the internet. You cannot access it just by typing in the URL for the Silk Road in your browser. But once you're there and you have an account, you can buy whatever you want. Most people are going there for drugs.
Mm-hmm. And it's been called the eBay for drugs, right?
I think that's accurate because you basically have a bunch of sellers who are selling everything from crack cocaine to, I don't even know, but they're probably selling rocket launchers for all I know. But they have feedback from their customers. It is very much like eBay. And the administrator of this forum created an account on the Silk Road in my name and then had it sent to my house. Mm-hmm. Well, the goal was to, once it was delivered, call the police by spoofing one of my neighbor's phone numbers and complain that I was, you know, having drugs shipped to the house.
Okay, so you're watching Fly and his pals. What was your reaction?
At first, it was kind of hard to believe. Then I decided, well, it's probably a good idea to just let the local cops know. So I called the local Fairfax County police and said, can you send somebody out to take a report? It took me about 20 minutes to explain what was going on. And fortunately, I had screenshots and other visual aids. But the guy took the report and he said, if they follow through on this, just give us a call. Here's your case number. It was funny because this guy was shaking his head the whole time. The policeman kept saying, you know, I can't get off the internet fast enough. By the time I retire, I want Google to know nothing about me. And then a few days ago, Fly updated the thread and said, all right, the heroin's on its way. I've got a tracking number for anybody who wants it. It should be at Krebs's house on Tuesday morning. And it came via U.S. Postal Service. Our nice mail carrier lady who comes every day, she knocked on the door and handed it to me. And it was basically an express mail envelope. And inside was a magazine from the Chicago Tribune. And taped to the back of that magazine were 13 individual packets of heroin. So I called the police and I talked to the non-emergency dispatch people. And funny enough, I'm getting to be on a first-name basis with these cops because I called and started to tell her my story. And she goes, oh, Mr. Krebs.
Oh, the heroin guy. Yes.
Yes, the heroin guy. How can you forget? So I said, look, I really want to know if this is the real deal. And she said, oh, well, it's not a problem. All the cops in Fairfax County carry field test kits. Anyway, the guy comes out. And he's like, oh, I have a field test kit in my car. Well, it turns out he was all out of heroin tests. So I still don't know whether it was a real deal.
You know who this guy Fly is. You don't want to say that's fine. Mm-hmm. You say you don't know what he has against you. I just don't believe that.
You know, I think a lot of these guys, to the extent that they have tried to harass me, they do it because they can. It really doesn't take that much effort. There are a lot of things you can do just with a few mouse clicks to make somebody have a bad day.
Don't you worry about these guys that they might stop pranking and start, you know, plugging?
I certainly do take personal security very seriously, and it's something I think about quite a lot. But I don't consider what I do to be any more or less dangerous than, say, people who get sent to war zones or covering any other topic that involves organized crime.
You know, when people describe cyber war, they often describe these massive interruptions of commerce. The kind of thing you're engaged in feels like a one-man cyber war. Should your average web denizen be worried about it?
Are you asking whether sending drugs to people's house via the Silk Road and trying to frame them with the police is going to be the next big thing?
Well, if you put it that way, it sounds like a stupid question.
No, I don't think it will. They're not going to do this to your average internet user, but they might interact with those users in other ways, you know, like steal their identity or their credit card numbers or what have you.
Brian Krebs, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Brooke.
Brian Krebs writes about computer security at KrebsOnSecurity.com.
The city of Detroit filed for bankruptcy 2 weeks ago, and since then, it has been the focus of national attention. The filing itself wasn't especially surprising. There was a long run-up to Detroit's insolvency. But the spectacle of a once great American city unable to pay for basic services is ominous. What's worse, pundits and pontificators have seized on the moment to lay blame on their favorite targets and reductively declare that what ails Detroit is a microcosm of what ails America. On Fox News, Rush Limbaugh told Greta Van Susteren that it was all the Democrats' fault.
That town has been a petri dish of everything the Democrat Party stands for. Massive unions, massive pensions.
On Fox Business, John Stossel blamed a corrupt mayor protected by political correctness.
When people criticized him and his fellow politicians, he called the critics racist. That generally shuts people up.
And on NBC, Melissa Harris-Perry said Detroit exemplified the perils of small government.
It seems to me that Detroit, as always, is standing in for all kinds of things about America.
Right.
This is what it looks like when government is small enough to drown in your bathtub. And it is not a pretty picture.
We asked Detroit historian Kevin Boyle whether he thinks Detroit is a perfect metaphor for America's industrial decline.
So it's not a perfect metaphor for all of industrial America, but it does capture a piece of industrial America, maybe the most dramatic piece of industrial America's rise and fall. The way to think about Detroit in the early 20th century is as one of the great boom towns of the world, the center of the world's most innovative industry. It was Silicon Valley, the 1910s, 1920s. And because its growth was so concentrated and so focused on a single industry, its fall has been very similar in its speed and in its depth.
And what is the story about? Is it about corruption? Is it about mismanagement? Is it about loss of tax base?
It's about deindustrialization on a really unprecedented scale. It's about the complexities of race and racial tensions. It's about white flight on a massive scale. It's about economic flight, the loss of a middle class, black and white. And it's all of those things interacting with each other to create, in some ways, a sort of perfect storm for the city. What then happens is that people in the media put on that story particular spins that shift the analysis away from those long-term structural problems, and it becomes a vehicle for talking about something else.
I detected, particularly on Fox, a certain element of schadenfreude. Just as we always told you, these black people cannot be trusted to handle their own affairs. Look what comes of your liberalism. Was I imagining that?
I certainly saw a lot of the latter, that this disaster is somehow the consequence of liberal social policy, not simply on Fox, but in more conservative print media as well. I've been surprised and pleasantly surprised that race has not been a central issue, but the degree to which the crisis in the city has been blamed on the welfare state, on municipal unions in particular, is really, really striking.
Journalism is pretty terrible at covering ongoing conditions. It tends to be very good covering the acute. Poverty and deindustrialization, they're just hard to cover because they require constantly paying attention to things that are changing only very incrementally, right?
Yep.
So an episode like the bankruptcy should actually be good news for those who do wish to shine some light on these ongoing intractable problems. Do you think that the press took advantage of the opportunity?
Yeah, I think some portions of the press did exactly that. I think if you're going to find a silver lining in the Detroit story, and that's a pretty hard thing to do right now, that that's one of them, that the mainstream media in America has a very hard time dealing with questions, particularly of intense poverty. The Detroit crisis is a way of getting at that reality, which is a reality for a substantial subset of the American population, in a way that makes it immediate.
How did the press do in adding some context and perspective?
There's been some really terrific reporting, and to me at least, the really most compelling reporting talks about the consequences of those problems down on the streets of Detroit. What does it mean to live in a place where 911 responses take almost an hour to get police presence? What does it mean to live in a place where the streetlights don't come on? Everyone talks about Detroit being hollowed out, but Detroit still has 700,000 people. Half the children in the city of Detroit live below the poverty level. A third of the people in the city of Detroit live below the poverty level. And because Detroit's now gotten this focus, and the story has legs, it really has. It's been a couple of weeks of news reporting now. The best reporting does use Detroit as a way of addressing those issues in a way that's really hard to do on an ongoing basis.
How do news organizations from this point forward continue to cover the story in the absence of some other big, you know, nominally cataclysmic event?
Trace out the choices that are made in how you move through the bankruptcy process and try to create something else on the other side of that process that can speak to the needs of the people of the city of Detroit and the values that we as Americans have for ourselves and for our fellow Americans. How do you rebuild a city that has reached this point of crisis? I think that's a really, really compelling story, and I think it's going to be really revealing of where we stand as a society in 2013, 2014, to see the answers that come out of that process.
Kevin, thank you very much.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this.
Kevin Boyle teaches history at Northwestern University.
Coming up, an uprising in the ranks of the unpaid intern.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone, and here's a clip from Disney's Phineas and Ferb.
With a paper jam, call, and he'll pick up the laundry team. Knows how to format, spell check, and text edit. He's working his job just for college credit. He's called the intern.
Unpaid interns are the subject of this segment. They've been in the news, as after last month's Asiana airline crash, when a Bay Area TV newscaster pronounced the names of the pilots.
They are Captain Sum Ting Wong, Wee Too Lo, Ho Li Fook, and Bang Ding Ao.
The National Transportation Safety Board blamed an unpaid summer intern. Did he punk the NTSB out of revenge? This was, after all, just weeks after over half a dozen lawsuits were filed by former unpaid interns agitating for back pay. We're doing this story because the media biz runs on unpaid interns. The producers of the 2010 movie Black Swan used them. Last month, a federal district court judge in New York ruled that Fox Searchlight Pictures should have paid two of them for their work on that film. After that, a deluge of lawsuits by former interns of W Magazine, The New Yorker, Gawker, Charlie Rose, who settled, and Atlantic Records by an intern from back in 2007, the year, incidentally, Atlantic released a new album by Rush. The interns claimed that the employers broke the guidelines laid down in the Fair Labor Standards Act, which are, one, the internship should be similar to training given in an educational environment. Two, the internship experience is for the benefit of the intern. Three, the intern works under close supervision and does not displace regular employees. Four, the employer derives no immediate benefit from the activities of the intern. 5, the intern is not entitled to a job at the conclusion of the internship. And 6, both parties understand that the intern is not entitled to wages for the time spent in the internship. Judge William Pauley, who presides over the U.S. District Court for New York's Southern District, ruled that Fox Searchlight Pictures violated both state and federal minimum wage laws by not paying those Black Swan interns.
He said that Fox Searchlight derived immediate benefit from the work of the interns. Also, it was displacing other workers. Under the law, they should have been paid minimum wage.
Attorney Maurice Pianco specializes in bringing lawsuits for unpaid interns who reach him through his website, Intern Justice.
It might be because of the Black Swan ruling. There are just really so many more interns that have had enough of this. And the truth is that they were most of the time exploited, and they want their pound of flesh.
Pianco has plenty of intern horror stories, and he brought us one. Meet Kevin Hicks, who's suing the production company behind Nickelodeon's short-lived teenage sci-fi soap opera, Alien Dawn.
I actually didn't know the first few hours whether it was going to be a paid internship or not. When I was told that it wasn't, I knew that there was supposed to be some sort of element of like, oh, okay, I shouldn't be taking out the garbage all the time and not being able to experience anything that's educational or beneficial to me. And that's exactly what they used us for. It was just bulk labor, cleaning up the garbage, carrying all the heavy cases, and we were not even allowed to be really on the set. They had us in holding, like in a separate area.
With Morris Pianco as his lawyer, Hicks is suing for twice the minimum wage he might have earned for his 2 weeks of work there.
For me, I'm told a little under $2,000. That would be the total amount that I would receive in the best of possible outcomes financially for me personally.
So this isn't really about the money?
Absolutely not. And I'm glad that you asked about the specifics because it makes it apparent that this is not like some kind of frivolous case of greed. I mean, it flagrantly broke the law every day that I was on that set. So I'd been talking to people about it, and it seemed to me that a lot of people know this is messed up and are either afraid to do something about it or they don't know how to go about it.
To avoid a lawsuit, the employer need only provide interns with an educational experience and not derive immediate advantage from their work. Of course, people may disagree on what that really means, like Stephen Colbert.
See, they're learning stonemasonry, from which I will not derive any immediate advantage for decades until my mausoleum is completed.
Some of the best internships are the ones where you say, I hate this, because then you know that's not what you want to do with your career.
Michael Maroney, director of communications at the Franklin Center for Government and Public Integrity, recently wrote in praise of unpaid internships on CNN's website.
Even if you are just moving boxes, you're making connections. You can still be gaining value out of that. I'm sure there are producers that got their start moving boxes. So while you might not be happy with it, I don't think suing your employer for back wages is really the right way to go about it.
You can make an unpaid internship work.
Blair Hickman is community editor for ProPublica, now gathering information on what it sees as an unexplored issue hiding in plain sight.
I think the issue comes down to, are they actually learning from the type of work that they're doing, or are they stamping letters and packing packages, or basically running the entire operation without much guidance, particularly in digital media? If there are 8 unpaid interns and 2 full-time staffers, one of whom might be in sales, how much guidance are these interns really getting?
And what about the long-term impact of unpaid interns in the media on the media?
If you're very poor and you can't afford to take an unpaid internship, are these people eventually going to be able to make it? Or are people from those backgrounds slowly going to peter out of the media voice? You know, someone who grew up in inner city Chicago, for example, is going to be able to do a bit of a better job covering inner city Chicago.
It is an unlevel playing field, and to pretend that it's not would just be incorrect. But I think there's other ways to level the playing field.
Maroney cites several organizations that assist or subsidize unpaid interns. He says interns who are exploited or abused can have a big impact by blogging and shaming their former employers, but they shouldn't sue.
I think if the interns win these suits, companies will be a little more skittish. A lot of them might end their internship programs altogether. There'll obviously be some people that start paying their interns, which is wonderful. But the amount of total internships available, paid and unpaid, will almost certainly decrease.
Let's say he's right, and paid internships increase, but the total number of internships drops. How would that affect the ultimate goal, jobs? According to the National Association of Colleges and Employers, this year, 37% of graduates received real job offers after unpaid internships. But compare that to 63% of graduates who got offers after paid internships. Now, NPR, a national organization, pays its interns, but many local public radio stations, including some of the biggest, like our station, WNYC, do not. We just ask our interns for heroic service, like Bill Murray's character does in The Life Aquatic.
What are you doing here? I thought all you interns ran out on me.
I want to help you find that shark.
God damn it. Thank you, intern. You're getting an A.
I can say that many of our interns have landed jobs here. I can say that most of them really do learn something of value. But I can't say that we don't derive immediate material benefit from their work. We do. It turns out that nonprofits are exempted, sort of, there's some dispute over how much, from the Fair Labor Standards Act. Michael Maroney, who argues in favor of unpaid internships, concedes that life is unfair. But he suggests that's one of the great lessons you learn from a lousy internship. When to walk, when to fight, like Outward Bound in the workplace. I guess that's one way to spend a summer vacation. Alex Goldman started out as an OTM intern. Now he's an OTM producer. I asked him to recount his epic journey to supreme job satisfaction.
I got a degree in journalism and then I needed to pay my rent. So I fell into a job that then consumed 4 years of my life.
Which was?
Fixing computers.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wasn't happy with it. So I decided to take a chance, knowing full well that I was moving on to a position that would pay nothing, at least in the beginning, and may not lead to anything.
We have generally two interns at a time, and their term lasts for 3 months. Your 3-month term expired, and it was time for you to move on.
And I didn't.
And we brought in two more interns, as we do.
Mm-hmm.
So what did you do?
I kind of made way as best I could. I was working afternoons Monday through Thursday, and then Friday through Sunday, I was a mover.
For another 3 months.
Yeah.
Two more interns came in, and then what happened?
Former OTM producer Nazneen Rafsanjani went on maternity leave, and being omnipresent as I was lucky enough to step in and fill her position. There were some staff changes, and over the next 4 or 5 months, I was still around and actually getting paid, and then I ended up getting the job.
A happy outcome.
It was a happy outcome, and I was extremely grateful for the opportunity at the time. I mean, I was working 6 or 7 days a week, but I don't ever remember coming in and feeling put out by the fact that I was doing it. I felt grateful for the opportunity to work on, you know, my dream radio show.
So eager to please that all unasked, you would take my paper, maybe other producers' papers, I don't know, to the recycling bin, something that you absolutely forbid our current interns to do.
I feel like there are two tasks that are too demeaning to make our interns do. I mean, aside from all the obvious stuff like picking up dry cleaning. But those two things are going out to get food for us and taking paper to the recycling bin. I feel like those are the two most non-nutritious tasks that we can ask people to do.
And we never asked interns to do that, but you are doing it without being asked. What's that about?
Are you trying to back me into saying I'm a kiss ass? I just felt like if I saw something that needed to be done, I did it. If you make yourself seem indispensable, people are less likely to dispense with you. It's a tough thing to say out loud to someone. Part of what makes them valuable is their willingness to sort of kind of fill in on the cracks a little bit.
So as you said, you don't remember ever coming in during that period and feeling resentful about being here. The sense of resentment only came after you started drawing a regular paycheck?
Strangely, I would say yes. And it's really on behalf of interns, because like I said, I didn't start feeling this way until I got paid. And part of that is just watching interns struggle in the way that I did, trying to find time to come into the station and get some value out of the job. We have two interns right now that come in and work sometimes full days and then immediately go afterward to do a full shift at a restaurant or wherever. And it's not that I think interns should suddenly become salaried, but I feel like enough to cover rent.
So we have two interns now, Olivia and Molly. Molly and Olivia are coming to the end of their internships, right?
Right.
So given that there won't be any blowback, Molly, get the hell in here. I like the alacrity. Molly Buckley, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Wow.
How pissed off are you?
At being an intern? I don't really resent it, even though logically I think that I should, maybe.
Unless you see it as part of your education.
Right.
So what is it that you're learning from this?
Technical skills, absolutely. Learning Pro Tools, I can see myself using that forever. Also, a big part of what I'm learning is how to pitch and what makes for a good radio show. I came into this with no background at all in radio, so that's really cool to see how you see things in sound.
You don't feel like it's not delivering for you?
No, I really don't. And I think one comforting thing is that in New York City, people are very familiar with this conundrum. So it's not I'm working two jobs, oh, you poor thing. It's like, oh, we've all been there. We've all done that. I did this last summer. I worked for 150 straight days or whatever. Everyone has their story.
Alex, why don't you come back here? Just leave it rolling. Alex, you're going to take this spot. It's only a two-mic room, so if I have questions, I'll yell them. You were saying from the control room that...
One of the things that made the internship difficult for me, I think it's endemic to every internship. It's this process of figuring out how to sort of ingratiate yourself with the people with whom you are doing the internship without being really annoying. That's a fine tightrope to walk.
That is very true, yeah.
And I was so intimidated by all the producers and the hosts when I first got here. I developed this weird metric in my head of like, I will interject into one out of every five conversations in order to make my presence known, but not in a way where it feels like I'm trying to dominate every conversation and be a know-it-all.
Yeah, trying to figure out when people want your opinion, like when we have the editorial meetings, when I should say what I actually think and when I should say what I feel would be best in the situation to think. I get myself into a funny situation with, you know, online or things like that. I feel like I would know maybe or how to appeal to a younger audience and stuff like that. There's a line of like, maybe I'd be useful here. And then on other things, maybe I wouldn't.
Part of what you have to learn is how to fit into an already existing structure and figure out how you can make the biggest contribution that you can most efficiently.
I think the difference is that when you're an unpaid intern, no one's going to say, no, Molly, you're wrong. Whereas to Alex, they might say that. But to me, they're going to be like, well, we don't tend to do these things because of so-and-so.
You get extra niceness because you're not paid.
But that's a lot of the time why I don't want to shoot out things that I think might easily be shut down is because if I'm just testing it, I don't really believe in it fully. I don't want to throw it out there and then burden everybody else with having to be nice when it's just a quick thing that I didn't really care about.
I think that's exactly right.
The first segment that I produced was on the We Are Watching You act, and our senior producer, Kat Rogers, on my first pitch, she said, I don't think so, or something very quick like that to that effect. And that was a good moment for me because I realized, like, oh, I can just pitch and she'll say no. She'll just do it. And that was over, and then I fought for it, and we got it produced.
There are a lot of interns who will go the 3 months without ever producing. And it's just a question, I think, of assertiveness.
And that's what I'm talking about. You do have to test the water, I think, to know where your voice is needed because internships themselves vary. So coming from my unpaid internship last summer to this unpaid internship, there was a little bit of an adjustment process where you just have to learn the social culture. And I think being an outsider to that is probably the hardest part.
So, as you just heard Molly say, everybody has a story. And on Twitter, we asked you for yours. We got quite a few, and most of them, from what I could tell, are surprisingly unbitter. Bradley Campbell lived in his car on a diet of day-old baked goods to complete his internship at public radio station WCAI in Cape Cod. He said it was like taking a vow of poverty to become a monk, and he still practices public radio daily. On the other hand, during Michael Kohan's internship at a sports radio station, the program director, the person who hired him, was fired 2 days before his first day on the job. Then half the local on-air staff quit, sometimes in the middle of a show. About half the sales staff quit. The station manager was fired. The station changed formats to news talk. On the bright side, he was offered a part-time position. Did he take it? Find out the end of his story and a lot of others on our website, onthemedia.org.
Now, of course, I have to protect my reputation as a newsman. I can't be selling my name to the highest bidder. So instead, I'm selling my intern's name. Halls, get out here! So, how does it feel to be America's number one cough drop, Halls?
My name is Jay.
Not anymore.
So my legal name is Halls Mentholiptus?
No. Technically, it's Halls Mentholiptus with Triple Soothing Action presents Jay the Intern.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary. We had more help from Olivia Wheats and Molly Buckley. And the show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson, who had a baby girl, Vivian, this week. Congratulations, Jen.
Congratulations. Send more pictures.
Our engineers this week were Andrew Dunn and Ken Feldman. They gave birth to no one.
Catcher Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.